This is Kate Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Welcome to this episode of Herding Code, being recorded on August 5th, 2010. Tonight we have a free-for-all discussion. Questions from Twitter, questions from email. Scott Kuhn is in Kansas, and we're very excited about this show. Is that right, guys?
Is that a lightning round question?
Yes, that's the first lightning round
question. Just a second. I am excited.
Did you make your saving throw?
I didn't need to.
All right, first question is from Matt Casto on Twitter. He wants to know what we think of LightSwitch, which, if you haven't heard, was announced this week, I think, at VS Live. It's Microsoft's new data access strategy, although it's not really the data access strategy. It's just a data access strategy.
Another
data access strategy. What does John want to add to that or think about LightSwitch?
Am I going first?
Yeah, I think so. Because honestly, I haven't
so you guys
paid
can all beat
too
me
much
up
attention
afterwards.
To it. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, if you could just explain it a little bit. I'm sure you have the official line on this.
You know, I don't really have official stuff. I've just, you know, read probably what you guys can have read. But basically it looks like the idea is it's a simplified interface on Visual Studio, and it lets you, you know, work like you're in Visual. It's kind of very similar to like Access Forms, except that it's generating end-to-end code with that can run on Silverlight. And then the idea is that you can upsize without, you know, like none of us have seen the code that it actually generates, but the idea is that it's supposedly generating code that can be extended on.
I thought it was generating web code. Or is that web matrix only?
From what I saw, I don't believe this is HTML web code at all. I think this is just...
Well, so it does Silverlight, which can run out of the browser or in browser, right?
Sure, right.
Okay, so it's because that's I literally have not seen this or read anything other than in 140 character byte.
Mm. So this isn't just data access then. This is application building.
I wouldn't think of it as data access at all. It's not like another data access library or another way of getting at data.
It's forms over data app building.
It's forms over data, and it's not web HTML forms over data. It's, you know, Jimmy that builds intranet stuff, you know, in IT needs to hook up a thing to track returns on product B for a recall that, you know, I mean, it's just very like, it's the stuff that would be normally done in an Excel spreadsheet with three tabs with maybe a little VBA and a bunch of formulas or, you know, that kind of thing or Access. Mm-hmm. So
that's what I thought. I thought it was the latest because Access has been kind of quiet. It's been there, but not doing much. I thought this was like the latest attempt to revive the Access, MS Access kind of paradigm, where you have something where you can very quickly put up forms that will collect data and run reports on.
Yeah. But not like, I think the key thing, it's not HTML forms. It's, you know, like, executable
it's
desktop.
WPF or Silverlight forms. Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess if the question was...
So it's literally like Access Form.
Yeah.
Except you don't have to run it inside of Axe, you run it inside of Silverlight. In browser, out of browser.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess, I mean, was the question what I thought of it or just what it is? Because since none of you guys know, I think I got the what it is locked.
The question is, what do we think of it?
So my thought is, I haven't seen the code, but I think that I think it's generally good. The one thing is that, you know, people worry that it's going to, things that spit out a bunch of code are tough to deal with later, but my response to that is when I've worked on this sort of thing, the pain that I've had to deal with is when people figure out all this stuff instead of using a common template. So, you know, Jimmy in accounting whips this thing up, searches around on the internet, finds some VBA code, pastes a bunch of stuff in, doesn't know anything about code separation, doesn't know anything about tiers, doesn't know anything about not putting things in the UI and all. And so those are the things that make it ugly. So there's at least the possibility here that these templates are actually generating better code than novice coder is going to do. So from that point of view, I think it's positive. I don't know. That's me. Okay, you guys trash me. Dogpile.
Well, one common theme I saw, I was at a conference earlier this week when they announced this, so I couldn't, like, work in a booth doing stuff in sessions. I couldn't, I couldn't actually go and look at the thing and get a real thing, a real, you know, review of it or look at it. What I thought was interesting about the snippets I kept seeing come across Twitter, all the complaints were, you know, this is another thing where non-professionals are supposed to write code that professionals will then have to maintain or take forward and whatnot. And it seems to be that it was kind of an arrogant view. And I tried going off with a metaphor about how, you know, only professional musicians should be allowed to write music. These kids that are using tablature, you know, just don't. They should learn music theory. And should, you know, they shouldn't be using electronic tuners to tune their instruments. You know, tuning against 440 hertz A and going from there tuning their guitars. And a lot of people didn't quite get that I was drawing a parallel between what they were saying about light switch and amateur programmers and what I was saying about amateur. I think that something like this is fine, and I think, yeah, you're going to have people that write really bad code that then, you know, maybe you have to maintain or take forward, and you have to pull it apart and massage it to turn it into something decent and maintainable. But that's kind of the status quo now anyway. You've got non-pros that are doing that in regular Visual Studio, or maybe people that aren't as advanced, let's say, not even non-pros. Maybe they're junior-level devs just to haven't learned these things. You can't... I think there's got to be some kind of learning curve. You can't start in the deep end of the pool, and you know, you can't learn how to swim until you get in the water, I guess, is what I'm saying. You can't not be allowed in the pool if you don't know how to, you know, swim in the Olympics. How many tortured metaphors have I thrown out there so far? Like, what, five?
Using too many metaphors is kind of like putting too many spices in a
spice cake.
Yes.
Yeah. So there's general complaints about that and this Microsoft data, which I haven't even looked at, never heard of. Maybe I've seen. They show us demos of these things in session summits for insiders. And they used code names, and then later on they come out with different names. I'm like, have I seen this before? They all pretty much look the same. They all end with the tagline without writing a single line of code, or, you know, makes it easier to, you know, program. It was what they all boil. And I think there's a market for that. I can't complain about someone putting out a tool that I'm not going to use. That's kind of the way I look at it. Like, sure, whatever.
What does Kevin think?
I'm extremely skeptical of the whole thing. Like Scott said, I mean, there's this ongoing thing out of Microsoft, this ongoing theme of, like, you know, you should be able to write code without knowing how to code. You can be able to write applications without knowing how to write applications. Without knowing how to write code. And that never seems to work out. You always start hitting these major walls with these tools. And as soon as you do, and to me, this tool, like, if they pitch this tool at the market that they're pitching WebMatrix at the quote unquote hobbyist, that to me makes a lot more sense. But they're actually pitching this as, you know, an enterprise tool, where somebody basically, you know, creates like the first version of the application and then hands it over to the real, quote unquote, real developer to finish it off. And that is just, you know, that just makes me cringe, because I would be the guy that they hand it off to. And, you know, we haven't seen a lot of details on it, so there's obviously a lot of open questions. But, you know, how do you version the thing? You know, how does it work with source control? Like, what's the sort of, you know, how deep a cliff do you go off of as soon as you start hitting its limitations? All those things are big open questions. But, I mean, this recurring theme of, you know, make it possible for non-coders to code, it always seems to be a pipe dream. It always seems to be, as soon as you get past the simple stuff, you go off a cliff, and, you know, it becomes my problem.
Very good. I guess I have to give an opinion, too. My opinion would be, you know, it's great if anyone wants to build a tool like the old Access tools so that Jimmy in accounting can build something that makes him productive day to day. But I would cringe if this is something that's designed for a business user to start and hand it over to the real developer. I think that's would be of concern. I think those tools work really well. I mean, the things like Access and so forth. I know someone that I graduated from high school with just pinged me the other day. He works for a county here in Maryland doing something with agricultural management or something through the government, and they have a 10-year-old application that was written in Access. He's looking for someone to make some modifications to it. I politely declined that work, but, you know, I bet they have a return on investment in that application. I don't know who wrote it, but I'm sure they probably didn't put a lot of time or thought into it. It's been working for him for 10 years. Now they need to make some changes. Probably doesn't have to be completely rewritten. Just needs a couple tweaks. But, you know, if non-professional developers can work with computers to make their lives better or make their businesses better, I think that's great. So give them all the tools they want. But I kind of wish those tools didn't come from Microsoft now, because I think Microsoft's done such a good job over the last 10 years actually positioning themselves as delivering tools for the enterprise, delivering stuff for professional developers. I don't think they can really serve two masters anymore. I think it would be great if they spun off another company and said, yeah, here's a company that's going to target hobbyist developers, PHP developers, the casual developers, the people that just want to build something and put up a family photo album on Azure without even knowing what Azure is. That would be great. But Microsoft doing it just seems to cause, at this point now, it causes either fear or confusion or makes people angry. And the people it's targeted to, I think, would be the ones that would be confused just looking at all the different things that you can get from Microsoft and how do I even know where to start.
Well, they never seem to announce things at user-oriented conference. Do they even have user-oriented conference? It seems like all the conferences are targeted towards developers. Like they don't have a Windows Live.
Well, they
have VS Live, and they don't just have people who are maybe power users of Windows or just kind of the general. I think there's an Office one, but that's about as close as they get.
They have this Worldwide Partner Conference, which a lot of that stuff is more kind of I don't know.
Yeah, but that's more. I mean, partner is a different ecosystem.
Sure.
Than
yeah, that's true.
User.
But I mean, how would that kind of conference work with Jimmy in accounting? Again, poor old Jimmy. But would he go to a conference where they're going to announce Lightswitch? Like, I'm not sure who who would go to those conferences?
I don't know. Well, they haven't really done one. I mean, TechEd used to be, TechEd and PDC used to be really separate. Mm-hmm. TechEd used to be IT professionals, and you learned about stability and the different servers and setting them up and all that junk. And then you had PDC where you did developer stuff and yada and all that, and it was very code-oriented. And now the two have kind of meshed together where you have all the developer sessions mixed in with the IT stuff. And PDC did that too with the Azure announcement and kind of mixed in stuff about server, 2008 R2 with Azure and AppFabric. And it was all kind of melded together.
I think some of it, is that, you know, the whole development world moves so much faster now. Like it all was so easy, you know, 10 years ago or 5 years ago when you could release software and once a year talk about here's what's new on the web stack or here's what's new in programming or you know what I mean. But now it's like it just everything moves so much faster that it's like, you know, if we only heard about new stuff at PDC, I don't know if that would keep, you know, it'd be weird.
Yeah, it just seems like that if they're gonna announce these kind of things targeted more towards, you know, people who aren't going to be upset by it or the people who are actually going to be using more than one.
Right.
I don't know. I think that instead of working on these apps that spit out working code, I think they need to work on apps that spit out parsable business logic or something that devs can then take and say, oh, this is kind of how they want the workflow to work. They've marked these things as required, you know, these fields and being able to, you know, specify that kind of workflow and business logic without actually generating code. So that then devs could take that and say, okay, this is kind of what they want and go from there and iterate on the actual app.
Maybe something like executable specifications.
There we go. They should, you know, if they put front ends on, you know, spec flow or RSpec, things like that.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
It might be a little bit. I mean, that's been the promise with BizTalk since, like, what, 1999, 2000, around in there? Supposedly, you know, you just be able to draw out the workflow of your XML documents, the flow of information through it, blah, blah. But it always seems to do that, but only for very specific, you know, golden, you know, yellow brick road, so to speak, paths.
Well, there's lots of questions to get through tonight, so let's go to another one. Detroit Pro wants to know what we think of Orchard, which is the ASP.NET content management system, I'm pretty sure is what he's referring to.
They just hit like 0.5 or something.
Yep.
And they're actually saying, you know,
2 days ago.
They're saying like this is the release that works, so to speak. You know, they seem to feel comfortable letting people install this and work with it, kind of.
Is it just me or is Orchard really kind of flying under the radar?
Yeah.
It is.
No one's paying much attention to it. They're too busy installing Umbraco and everything else, and I think it's going to hit big one day.
Well, it seems like Orchard is their WordPress. And WebMatrix is their, you know, their PHP customization system for their WordPress. I mean, does that read jive with you guys?
From what
I think talking to like Bertrand and the other guys on the team, Louis Desjardins, instead of WordPress, I'd compare it maybe to Drupal, a little bit more full-featured and developer-friendly, whereas WordPress is kind of a mess if you're a developer. It's great if all you want to do is put up content and stuff, but I think it's more like a Drupal. It's very extensible. They've spent a lot of time looking at the module and plugging a filter system and, you know, letting devs get at the content in very structured, extensible ways.
I think the absolutely most fascinating part of Orchard is if you go to the source code and look in the lib directory, what you see there, you see AutoFat, Castle Windsor, Fluent and Hibernate, jQuery, which that's not a big surprise, I guess, but Mock, NHProf, Sharp Ziplib, Specflow, YAML, YUI. Pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
There's no Unity here. There's no entity framework code first folder that I can see.
Yeah, it definitely has that feel of like, let's just build something that's like, you know, let's build the best thing and not make sure that we're, you know, like by being kind of more under the radar, like you're saying, it just seems like it's more like, let's just build an awesome product that people will use. Yeah, it seems
they're not paying the strategy tax. I'm really curious how they're getting away with that. This is like a first out of Microsoft as far as I've seen.
Well, it could be because they're flying under the radar. They're not pushing for the big announcements and session stuff at PD TechEds and VS Lives. They're doing little sideband things. Like, oh, we're having a bird's feather about Orchard.
Yeah, if this was on the front page of the Mix site, there'd be hell to pay somewhere.
Yeah, they'd probably if someone's phone would be ringing more.
I think also database-wise, there's interesting stuff as far as like what kind of data access is supported. I mean, like you're saying, did you see Fluent and Hibernate in there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Fluent and Hibernate, Lincoln Hibernate, it's using in Hibernate, it's using Lucene.
Yeah, and then you know there's different data access things, but they had from you know there's a SQL CE data services provider and stuff like that. So neat stuff.
Detroit Pro also wanted to know what we thought about Nuu, which is the gems in .NET, using gems to manage dependencies in .NET.
We can't talk about this one because we're interviewing those guys next week.
We were going to interview them this week, and then we.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's great. Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, I guess John, I'll just erase that.
No, that's fine. I mean,
it's another 30 seconds of my life that's gone.
It's a preview of coming attractions. Oh, I'll tell you what I think about Nuu next week.
John's so polished at this. All right, Matcha Hack, Matcha Hat. It's not Mocha Hack. Matcha Hack. MachaHack. That's the Twitter handle. If you were going to learn to program all over again, what would you do differently, Kevin?
Oh, man.
Yeah, this is a hard one.
That is a tough one.
Yeah.
What would I do differently? Okay, go to somebody else because I got to think about this.
I just had a thought. I could throw something in.
Go ahead.
Which is just that over the last, I don't know how many years it's been now, I've finally started to realize something. Just taking a very different perspective than what I had, say, like the first 5 years of my career, which is if something's really hard, it's because I'm not very smart and I can't understand it. And I'm just not, I don't know, I need to do something to understand this API or how this works. The last few years, I've taken a different approach, which is just if it's too hard to understand, maybe I'm still not very smart, but, you know, I can find something that's going to be easier to work with out there. And, you know, some of that might just be because there's so many choices available now versus when I first started, where if you had a computer and you got a compiler running on it, well, that one compiler, you're pretty much set. That's the only one available. So if I was going to do something differently, it would be to not spend so much time fretting over things and I don't know, just use a more have a more critical opinion about the tools I'm using and the languages I'm choosing and things like that, to question things. Why was it built this way? Why does it have to be hard? Why can't we do something to be more productive and make this easier? I wish I would have started that a lot earlier in my career. What about John?
Yeah, I'll go. Because actually, I saw this question come in and I've been thinking deeply about it since then. Because this is kind of like in your programming professional life, what would you do? You know, I mean, it's a big question. The two that I've been going back and forth between is starting earlier, because this is like a second career. I was in the Navy first. And I know a lot of us kind of drifted into programming, but I wish I'd known that programming was I would have been a computer science major. I would have, dug into this stuff earlier. But barring that, I wish that I had gotten involved in open source earlier, because it just took... I started, just learning from people that were in my office, and I started, it took a long time to kind of make connections and get kind of to learn from people, to find people that were, thinking about a lot more than just what was going on in their, what they had to do in work. And the thing that really kind of has kickstarted that for me has been open source development. I just learned so much. It forces me to learn. It puts me in contact with people. It builds out a network. So I think that's the thing that I would do. It's just, get involved with open source earlier.
Scott calling in from sweltering Kansas.
I probably would have done the opposite kind of what Kay Scott said. I was thinking about this and I thought, I probably would, if I was learning, I would go back and I would start with like C and systems level programming, which is probably the hardest to understand and the easiest way to shoot yourself in the foot. Mm. I'd probably start there, and then I'd work into like lists and things like that. I probably would have gotten some, I would have taken some academic course in programming just to kind of get that level, and then I would have done more in the real world too. I would have done the, because now it feels like I'm always trying to retrofit kind of the not really the basics, fundamentals, stuff like algorithms and set theory and stuff like that. I'm trying to, that's not innate. But that would have required me living a different life and not trying to go through biochem and go for PhD and whatnot. So,
See, while you were doing biochem, I was destroying thermal printers with bad assembly code.
See? It's all programming. It's just that I had much fewer symbols in my language, and there was even less documentation.
And now we come back to Kevin. He's had time to think about this question, and he's ready to go. Listen to this now.
Okay.
Here's Kevin.
I would do the opposite of both K. Scott and Scott K.
Well, that's not possible.
But you would still be a farmer?
That's like saying infinity plus one.
Exactly. I think, there are certainly things that I've, in the abstract, I would do differently. Although, I certainly am not happy with it, not unhappy with it, where I am now. But in the abstract, I think I would also would have done more CS in school. I sort of started down that road and then bailed out and kind of wish I hadn't. But also, I think I would just try to have pursued a little more variety in my career, like trying different kinds of things. I've sort of been doing enterprise software, my whole career. And, I think just learning lots of different kinds of things, internet programming, high scale stuff.
SharePoint just, web parts.
Well, okay, not that. but just a sort of broader experience, I think. Solving interesting different kinds of problems as opposed to purely enterprise software, which is, it's interesting, but there are certain kinds of problems that you will never tackle in the enterprise software space.
See, the reason I thought about the systems programming and C programming was I spent a day on Monday in a session, an all-day session with some of our product development leaders at F5, and they're talking about how the custom module, Linux modules they write for some of our hardware products, and kind of at that level and what their concerns are when they're talking about, taking 6,000 requests per second through a router. You actually run into some of these performance things people just kind of talk about in the abstract in app code. Should we use a for each here? Or, when you're going to hit that piece of code, 6,000 times a second, then suddenly it starts to become a little bit more important how tight that loop is. And the decision to move a function call out of process versus staying in process, because when it's out of process, if that fails, at least the entire request won't fail. That those kinds of things were kind of interesting. So maybe that's coloring my belief. That's just the way I work. That's the reason I went into biochem. I want to know how things work. I want to get down. I want to understand it at that level, and then layer the abstraction on top and get higher up to the point where I don't have to think about it at that level.
So is this an F5 conference?
Yeah, it was our customer and partner conference, and we had our MVP. We had just started an MVP program last January or February. We announced them. We had six of them. We brought them in to talk to. You know, we have a product called iRules, which lets you write a little tickle script that execute on every request that comes into the router.
Huh.
And so we talked to the guy who created those, and we had him come in and explain how they work and why they work, and to our MVPs who have been, you know, writing these kinds of iRules for years. And they talked to the hardware guy, where he talked about how the boards are put together and how they design them. And you know, that was fascinating to see to hear them talk about how the reason that we have the limits that we do in our hardware is mainly because of bus. Like the processor and the RAM speed is no longer a limitation. It's the actual bus. How quickly can we get information from the RAM to the processor and around the board? You don't really run into that problem in app code.
See, I think if I went to an F5 conference, I'd expect to walk into the auditorium and there'd just be like racks and racks of hardware on the stage and 10,000 blinking LEDs, and no one would actually talk. Everyone would just be really quiet, and you just try to hear like bits race around through all the hardware.
We did have a rack at our booth of our Vyprion product and our storage product and everything else. The Vyprion is like it's got four blades in it, and it's the ludicrous router. It goes to plaid, basically.
That's a pretty cool name too, Vyprion.
Yeah, it's insane.
Vyprion. Interesting.
The kind of people that need Vyprions are like NBC, and not for their websites. They're using them for their actual internal traffic.
Well, so,
like, they used them in Beijing for the Olympics.
Speaking of Vyprion, Matt Casta wants to know what our favorite energy drink is. And I can start off by saying I don't think I've ever had an energy drink other than coffee, but I've never tried Red Bull or anything like that. What about you, Scott?
Huh. Generally just black coffee, but sometimes I'll grab those Starbucks double shots, the vanilla. I think those are good. The Red Bulls are nasty.
Mr. Calloway?
I have had to take my energy drink thing to a new level this summer with traveling and jet lag and having to teach an all-day class and the kind of things you laugh at, K-Scott, but were pretty tough. And so I started by the standard slam coffee, eat a bunch of candy bars and stuff, because I would do great until like right before lunch, right around lunch, and then like I would just lose it, you know, like I would not have any energy and just start falling off, and then it's like, oh no, I need coffee, I need sugar. And so I had two revelations made to me. One was from James Sr. And he had learned this, I guess, from Scott Hanselman, but the trick is to use energy bars with a lot of protein. So like 30 plus grams of protein per bar, and eat one of those every 2 hours, like every you know, couple of breaks or whatever, just pound one down. And they give you energy that doesn't drop off. And so the one other one that I learned from Dan Wallin was that if you can't find those or whatever, that the 5-hour energy actually works, those cheesy commercials. And so I tried that in New York, and I felt great, although at one point I told the crowd that I was ready to fight them all. And I think I think I looked serious enough that, you know, nobody laughed when I said that. So maybe 5-hour energy is a little too intense, but it did give me at least 5 hours energy, and I didn't have that kind of sugar coffee drop off.
The 5-hour energy thing's horrible.
They don't taste good. None of the energy stuff tastes good. Gasoline also probably doesn't taste good, but it makes your car go so fast.
Mm. So there's a lot of truth to protein. One of the things that I learned, and this is me getting to use my degree, I guess, that the metabolism of protein yields a longer return of carbs and sugars over time. So instead of eating like donuts and stuff for breakfast to get going with your coffee, have some bacon or ham or eggs, and you'll end up, your brain actually functions better with the slow release of kind of sugars over time than it does if it just gets a quick burst of like Diet Pepsi or Coke or something.
What about Kevin? Is Kevin an energy drink junkie?
No, I am a good old-fashioned coffee guy.
Very good.
Yeah, I'm old-fashioned that way.
So I guess Herding Code is not going to be get a sponsorship from any sort of energy drink people.
We're not going to be driving around with the Red Bull on the back of our little Jeep.
No,
Have you seen those?
Yes. Jim Holmes wants to know, cake or pie, in honor of Steve Horn.
Is there a joke there? Because I don't know what the...
Well, I was waiting for someone to enlighten me.
I only know one joke there, which is that the cake is a lie, so I would go with the pie. But I don't know, maybe that doesn't mean the pie is not a lie. And then this is like the lady or the tiger sort of question.
See, I will match Jim, and I will go with Boston cream pie. It's a pie with cake in it.
Kevin, can you enlighten us at all? Or
I have no idea what the... Yeah. I'm not in on the waffle.
I have to say, if we appeal to authority, if you go to cakeorpie.org, that cake is winning, pie is in second place, and or is in a distant third place at 13%.
That's a fallacy. There should not be an or in there.
It's cake or pie, and you can vote on all three.
Cake and pie.
Oh.
Cake with a pie chaser.
Hmm. We're prejudicing cake, Scott. I should let you.
I'm going with cake. All right. Ross Jemson wants to know, why all the fuss about Microsoft.data? Are the complaining .NET developers just insecure/paranoid? I am a .NET developer and couldn't care less about it, and I'm not worried what other people are going to think, because most likely they won't even know or care themselves. I have a few friends that are Java developers, and I'm sure they wouldn't even know about it. Even if they heard about it, they wouldn't think differently about him just because Microsoft has this Microsoft data thing. So this is the piece that I think I was thinking about earlier, where it's the new data access mechanism for Microsoft, where you just point it to a database name and start firing queries, right?
Right.
Yes, correct.
Yes. And I think I've seen it inside of the views in WebMatrix, right?
I think that's what it was designed for. And so that's this whole kind of brouhaha started when David Fowler posted about it. And he posted one post, and then other people posted follow-ups, and he posted a follow-up. And yeah, it's like it seems similar to like the standard wrapper for ADO.NET that most people write. I think the thing that got people spun up, and I think kind of rightly so, but is it the way you're supposed to do it, and it supports using parameterized queries. But he had written in his first post, like, hey, look how easy it is, and he had not used a parameterized query. And I think that that's, you know, like people are going to copy and paste stuff, and it's just anything that makes that easy. I guess I'm answering the question here, and I wasn't invited to. but anyhow, that was the thing that got, I think, people most upset, probably, was that, you know, it's inline SQL executing a raw SQL string. And everyone's like, we've been down this road, and I hate SQL injection and stuff, right?
But is that true? Because my recollection of the original post was not that he didn't. I mean, that it did use parameterized queries. Let me rephrase that. Not that it didn't use parameterized queries, but it was actually a hard-coded query. So there was no SQL concatenation, but there was also no parameter.
Oh, right.
Okay. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So
saw was something like, give me the products where units in stock is greater than 20, and all that was... Yeah, hard-coded.
Oh, right, okay.
Right.
But it was dangerously close to a line of code that, you know, said, like, query string, give me something from the query string and put it in this variable.
Little bobby tables.
You know, it was close enough to make you say,
yeah.
Slippery slope.
Yep. Wacky thought on this was, I think that what if it was, there was, like, the call is db.query. And what if there was db.query and it required a parameter, like it only worked with parameterized queries. And then the only way you can do just execute a SQL string is something called db.unsafeQuery, or maybe db.query takes an overload that says, you know, like unsafe equals true, or you know what I mean? Like, I'm just thinking of like in C#, if you want to use pointers, that's great, but you're like taking your life into your own hands and you need to say unsafe. And it's not like, you know, unmanaged or, you know what I mean? I think that the term there, unsafe, was very, you know, it was thought out. Like, look, this is, you need to keep this safe because we're not doing anything for you. I don't know. I almost think like naming wise that there should be something where you have to make a conscious choice. And if you copy and paste some code, it should like give you a little warning like, maybe this isn't great code.
Well, it's not even that it should, you know, marked as safe or unsafe, I don't think. But you know how Razor by default escapes the HTML before it outputs it? You know, wouldn't you have wouldn't it be better if Microsoft.data would, you know, attempt to sanitize or try to run it and see what the query looks like before actually executing it against the database? Or if there's some kind of sanitizer or parser or something, security parser kind of thing. If it's truly meant for people who are not database professionals, then, you know, I wouldn't feel comfortable with the unsafe on there. I'd feel more comfortable with having it do the right thing by default. Like, not allow them to concatenate, only allow them to add parameters by, you know, using parameters.
I think it's actually really hard to discuss this thing outside of the context of WebMatrix, because it seems all kind of wrapped up.
Mm. Well, that and the fact that I've only seen people complain about it on Twitter. I haven't actually looked at any of the code or even the product page. I couldn't get it to come up on my one bar of...
That's how it works nowadays, Scott. This is the new world. Just
Twitter is the source of all knowledge now.
Complain on Twitter.
So what's your guys' take on the whole WebMatrix thing? On the whole notion of, like, you know, the hobbyist developer and all the stuff that we do as real developer, quote unquote, real developers is too complicated and they need simpler tools and all that stuff.
I think it's a great idea from the standpoint of the file new WordPress site, file new Orchard site, and then, you know, go from there and write your little modules in WebMatrix. But I think that they should have used a programming language more oriented towards beginners, like Iron Python, maybe. Not so much Iron Ruby too, sorry, but Iron Python. I've seen lots and lots of intro programming courses centered around Python. It seems to be a language that beginners can pick up. It lends itself to kind of the DSL creation, but it's not maybe as powerful as Ruby in aspect, but it's better than C. But no one asked me. Well, I guess you guys did.
Yeah, you just did.
Okay, Scott, how about you?
I also think it's great, but as I stated before, I wish this wasn't coming from DevDiv. I wish there was a... If they want to target hobbyists, I think it's wonderful. I just think there needs to be a clear separation. It's just going to create anger and confusion and...
Lead to the dark side?
Yeah, it's not giving me a good vibe at all.
Well, what other division would do it? Windows, it would never ship. Office would be 10 times too complex.
Or maybe even just different lines or something. You know, like there's... I mean,
exactly. I mean, some sort of clear delineation.
Like Visual Studio is at least the brand it's professional developed. Hopefully that's the idea, you know, and maybe there needs to be like a whole different like blanket brand similar, like, you know, there's Office, you know what you're getting with Office, and, you know, maybe just a different sort of brand name that just covers this kind of hobby entry level thing.
Right.
Well, so I always kind of take exception to this whole notion of professional developers, because I think that a lot of people have a different notion of what a professional developer is. I think Microsoft's notion of professional is paid to write code, and I think that some other people's notion of professional developer is more along the software craftsman line. Like, it's not professional to write bad code, that kind of thing. And I think that's where a lot of the bad feeling comes. Microsoft is writing tools for people to get paid to write code, and the rest just want tools people care about.
And then from that point of view, there's a difference in, like, people who are paid to develop applications are maybe happy if they don't need to write as much code, whereas people who care about code want to write code in general. You know, I mean, that is a weakness of I think that we, or not a weakness, it's a tendency that we have, is to care about the code.
Sure.
I don't know if I answered that. Was I supposed to? Oh,
well, you're
still answering.
John, do you want to give us your perspective?
I don't know.
As the Microsoft inside shill man.
Yeah, I don't know if I can. I will say this. I've had a lot of times where I've had, you know, my younger brother wanted to build something. He's a very smart guy, but he's not a programmer. He hasn't put in the time. He doesn't really want to learn to be a programmer, but he wants to build a simple website, you know. But he doesn't just want some HTML. And so, you know, before I would say, well, you know, get Visual Studio Express and stuff. And pretty soon I'm explaining things that are just way too complex. And, you know, and then I've had even things like where, you know, my wife wanted to do a simple website. And so I had her set up, you know, editing CSS. And this is just not, the right tool here, you know? And so then it's like, well, I can definitely see that there's a place for this kind of tool. And one other thing is I do know, like, for instance, the MVC Conf website, I don't think they made a huge deal out of that, but it was built with WebMatrix, and Eric loved it. He said, this is awesome. He said, you know, he's probably going to beat me up now, but he's like, for a quick, simple website like this, I would kick him out all day long. This is awesome. I just sit here. I mean, this is so fast, you know? And so, I mean, from the simple kind of get it done, I'm not going to agonize about code quality because this conference is going to be over in a month, you know. Like, I don't know, there's that.
Eric Hexter,
he's gonna, so wrap up, but here's, he probably wasn't supposed to say that,
but here's the question. So Eric Hexter can pick up that tool and run with it, but your brother, you know, if you told him, oh, here's this thing from Microsoft, do you think he'd still try that?
I do think at least like the IDE is simple enough where it's like pretty quick to say like, okay, here's where it is. Mm-hmm. I don't have to say go to tools, options, other windows, configure, blah, blah, blah. Then right. I think also the... I do think that the code at least has kind of more of that like PHP feel, like where you don't have to escape things and switch into code mode and out of code mode. I think a lot of it really will depend on how many apps are out there and how much mm-hmm. sample code and documentation, how easy it is to find stuff that you can draw from. But I do think that it is something where somebody like, you know, your cousin, your nephew, your whatever could mm-hmm. have a fighting chance at getting something done, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking more from a perception issue. Like if this wasn't your brother, if it was just someone who wanted to put together a web page, how many people think Microsoft now? Yeah, I was just thinking today back to like 1995, year 2000. Remember the Windows 95 release when Microsoft was doing so well in the consumer market? You had people lining up to buy Windows 95. You had people buying Windows 95. It didn't even have a computer. And about that time, I was walking into the boardroom at a Fortune 50 company, and the chief architect is telling us, we're not going to take stuff that you guys are building because you're building on Microsoft technology, and we don't believe it will scale. And that's like the year 2000. And now you fast forward 10 years, and I don't think if you go to a Fortune 50 company, you're still going to have those types of people that question, you know, the scalability of the Microsoft platform and blah, 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 blah. They've done such a great job at finally building stuff that's accepted in the enterprise, and they've completely left this other market behind, the cousins and the brothers and the Jimmy the accountant. You know, are they ever really going to be able to get that back, or are people going to look at it and say, oh my God, it's Microsoft? It's like, you know, I might as well be buying something from IBM now. Same thing with the Windows 7 phone. I think if it has the Microsoft brand on it, people are going to think, well, geez, you know, I don't read Excel spreadsheets on my phone anymore. I'm going to buy an Android. I'm going to buy an iPhone. I just think there's some things at this point where if they're going to succeed, they cannot have the Microsoft branding on them. They might as well just spin up another company. Yeah, if you walk out to consumers right now, you walk out to people on the street, the only thing that people think is even reasonably cool is the Xbox. And no one calls it the Microsoft Xbox, just the Xbox. But if you come out and talk about the Windows phone or the Microsoft phone, again, you know, you might as well try to sell them something from IBM, which lost contact with consumers decades ago. All right. Yes, Kevin?
Yeah, sorry. I got to chime in on this one because I made a comment about this the other day on Twitter, which is it's the kind of thing that Microsoft has done in the past where, you know, it's sort of a form of cargo cult programming where, like, they see, oh, PHP has the success, so we have to go do that too. Mm. And they're successful, and they look like this, therefore, if we make our stuff look like their stuff, we'll be successful too, without really, like, understanding the context in which that thing is successful. So, you know, Scott K. brought up the, you know, dynamic language thing. Like, that's a piece of it. There's this huge, you know, PHP is so popular in part because there's this huge ecosystem and people are just sort of tweaking templates based on this huge ecosystem that just isn't there in Microsoft. And it's, you know, maybe with Orchard, they're trying to bootstrap that ecosystem too. But PHP is a phenomenon that exists for a particular, you know, because of a particular history and a particular set of tools, and just copying that is not, you know, going to bring you success. So I think it's kind of a doomed strategy, even though I think the notion of, you know, hobbyist friendly tools is kind of a noble one.
Well, remember when hobbyist programming was actually kind of hard? Like, you know, you only had BASIC, or, you know, you had C on there, and then there was assembly, and those were your options. You know, you were on, like, on the Commodore 64, you had BASIC or assembly. You know, I think there was a COBOL implementation for PET in general. When the IBMs came along, you had C, assembly, or BASIC. And I think it's okay if programming is a little hard, but I also think it's okay to write tutorials and frameworks and things oriented towards hobbyists. Just don't affect the rest of them.
And that, by the way, is another reason why I think there's such a furor over Microsoft Data and Lightswitch and all this stuff, is that, you know, the Microsoft development community has spent years of, you know, our development lives having Microsoft pitch these, you know, you don't need to be a real programmer kind of tools, which the real programmers then end up inheriting and dealing with the pain of. And so I think we have a, we have a bit of a reflex reaction to things that fall into that category, or, you know, call it a gag reflex, maybe. I don't know.
Well, it's also kind of insulting to those that, you know, are professional developers, and here they keep trying to push the whole notion that, you know, without writing a single line of code, you don't have to be a programmer to develop apps.
It's
you kind of have to write good apps that don't crash.
It's did you guys notice there was there was some tool that came out recently where it was a Google thing where it was like you can write an Android app by dragging, clicking, hooking things together.
I saw that.
It's you definitely see that from Microsoft more lately, but I mean it's been kind of a holy grail, at least from the business sense in the community or computing business, for a long time. It's like people will pay money for something where they can, you know, hook up apps without needing developers to, you know, brainstorm about, you know, scalability or something. Well, whether or not it's, you know, possible.
Holy grail, isn't it? Good analogy there.
But again, then there are cases like, you know, MVC Conf website did just fine, you know, it worked. And going way back to like what Kay Scott was saying about this Access app that worked for 10 years and, you know, could have been a lot better probably. But again, you know, like I've worked with apps that I was not really happy with, but as a coder, but I mean, if from the business point of view, I could see why, you know, the business people would be like, yep, that was a success. I've worked on other apps where you know, we've had beautiful architecture. We had everything laid out, you know, and it, you know where it's going. It never shipped, or it shipped and was immediately shut off, or it lost money and was shut down or whatever, you know? And so, I mean, there is a big difference between the business side and the code purity.
And almost every company I've gone into, no matter what size, somewhere there's a little rinky-dink Access database that is mission critical to some vital area of the business.
Worse, an Excel spreadsheet.
Or an Excel spreadsheet, yeah, with everyone's, you know, salaries or bonuses or sales or whatever on it, yeah.
Which I mean, then at some point somebody emails out to the whole company.
They say that like the single largest, you know, enterprise application development platform is Excel. That holds the largest body of, you know, of application logic. Is kind of terrifying, but probably true.
One tab has the numbers, the next tab has the document.
Well, I think from that point of view, you know, a lot of what we get upset about when we see these simple tools is because we're comparing it to a well-architected application, whereas I think in a lot of cases the alternative was never going to be a well-architected application with us working on it from the beginning, getting to find the architecture. It was an Access app or, you know, a VB5 app or a, you know what I mean? It was whatever some random person built that didn't know what they were doing. So, I mean, we're saying, well, I don't want this simple tool. I want, you know, a clean architected app using this kind of stuff. And I'm not sure that was ever the choice.
I think the ideal would be is if there's a way to grow from that little app to the clean architected app. And maybe that's what they're trying to do with this light switch stuff. But that transition never seems to be, you know, a priority in these products. You go off the cliff.
Now, I did look while we were talking. I looked, and a light switch at least is running. It says it's three-tier. I just asked old man Wikipedia because I couldn't get the straight scoop on exactly how the code works.
Is it using Microsoft DNA?
No. Good question. It's using the new DNA. So it's got WCF RIA services, entity framework, hosted in ASP.NET, and blah, blah, blah. Or Azure.
Oh, wow. So it's like I don't like.
Yeah, well.
It's like... I bet it uses ASP.NET website projects and wizard controls.
It doesn't say that.
With a Bob interface. Too far?
Does it emit update panels?
No, because this is Silverlight.
Because I get really irritated when I have to write my own ASP:update panel run at equals server.
There's tools you can buy that'll emit that update.
As long as it has a random progress bar, that's all we need.
And a splash screen. Does it do a splash screen?
Yes.
These are the big questions. Well, anywho, this show's getting old, and we only have a few more questions to go. I think Ross was also asking a question. How did you get banned from chat.meta.stackoverflow? Did someone here get banned from the meta chat?
Yeah. Well,
was that you?
Maybe. I don't do well on that kind of thing. IRC, I used to always get kicked too. And it was like, no, I didn't mean that. I meant, so I was goofing around, but everyone else was pasting animated GIFs in, and I thought they were fun too. And Jeff has Jeff does not like animated GIFs, but I have an animated GIF of Jeff, and I'm not going to say Jeff. Just don't worry about that right now. But I have an animated GIF of Jeff wearing the banana suit from Peanut Butter Jelly Time. You know that one? And he's dancing, and it's an animated GIF. And so I pasted that in. I kept pasting it. And then they were like, cut that out. So I was like, I took the hint then, and then I thought, well, I wonder if this supports SVG. But I was testing using IE8. I run different browsers as default on different computers, and that one happened to IE8. So I was running on IE8, and I pasted in, and I just wanted to see what it would do because I knew it wouldn't render SVG. And so, but to other people that were using other browsers, it was, and they were like, quit pasting that image in. And it was actually the Herding Code logo. And so I did it like twice, and then all of a sudden I was banned. So
the Herding, so you're making us all look bad. Is what you're
yes.
We've probably all been banned. We've all been banned. Life.
Herding Code, spamming the earth.
And for a second I was like, well, wait a minute, man. And then I was like, you know, I really didn't be there. I mean, it's kind of like somewhere between Stack Overflow and Twitter and IRC. And it was interesting.
Did you just have your power bar when you did this? Your 5-hour energy drink.
Right. I told everyone I was going to fight him. But it was interesting. I don't know. I guess the idea is, you know, a third place. But if it's a third place where I'm going to get kicked out for pasting in funny animated GIFs, I'm not sure what it's for. I'm still bitter. This chat thing, though, the amazing thing, it's technically, it's all running with jQuery, and it's like doing crazy stuff. It was
what, like Ajax requests? Whoa.
No. I mean, like just the way, look at you. It's just everything is, it's really nice.
Ban him.
Everything animates in nicely. You paste in a YouTube link, it automatically, like, you know, converts it to a little YouTube player. I mean, it's just for two people built it.
You paste in an animated GIF over and over.
And you get automated.
You get auto
kick banned. Yeah. It's really a pretty slick interface. And two guys wrote it, Mark Gravel and Benjamin Dump.
Wait a second. You got banned. I found this thread. There's like 50 posts from Scott Hanselman.
Yeah.
He posted a trotting unicorn.
Yeah, I guess he was able to play it just right and, you know, wasn't kicked. But then Scott and I and some other people went over and started a new chat room, which you're allowed to do. And it was called Only Animated GIFs, or All About Animated GIFs. And there's some pretty good ones in there. I pasted in one of my favorite, which is Christopher Walken flying through space and time. So that's a good one. Yeah.
You're just a troublemaker. Hey, listen, Ross had another question, which is he had a friend in Australia that waited 11 hours for an iPhone 4. He wants to know if an intervention is required. What do you think, Kevin?
Only 11? Man, that's easy. I was there for 11 days, man. No,
did you wait for an iPhone?
No. Are you kidding me? Yeah. I pre-ordered online. That would be the sane way of going about it.
John doesn't have an iPhone, so you must think that this person's crazy.
They're neat. I don't think, yeah.
I wouldn't wait in line 11 hours.
I don't understand the need to have it first.
Right.
That's silly. Like, the people that go out and pay, like, $50 for an Xbox game the day it comes out, and then, like, 4 or 5 months later, it's $10 or $20. I don't understand that. It's the same with iPhones. Like, they're not going to stop manufacturing. It's not like you get a limited edition with your own little certificate and a number on the back where, like, Steve signed the first 500 iPhone something.
You know, I think it's...
You buy it, they make more.
I think some of it, so it's something to look forward to. It's something you're excited about, and so you want it. Like, the movie Inception, I was anticipating that movie quite a bit. I didn't see it right when it came out, but pretty soon after. I actually saw it twice, I'm going to confess. But it was something I was excited, and sure, I could have waited till it was on DVD, or I could have waited till longer, but I mean, I didn't wait in line to see it the day it came out, but I wanted to see it soon because I was looking forward to it. So, I mean, maybe there's some of that where it's like, I mean, Kevin, you pre-ordered, right? So, I mean, you want it soon. It's a good thing and you want it sooner than later.
Right. And I'm glad I did. I mean, it's a tremendous device. I would never like wait outside in line for it, but you know, some people that's like a social thing, you know, at least as far as computer geeks go.
Well, it's like they're lacking something.
An iPhone 4. I need an iPhone 4. I want the one with the megabits and the GBs. Does it have the Wi-Fis? Exactly. I want an iPhone 4. Haven't you seen that?
That was hilarious.
I had to force my friends to get in line so that I can FaceTime them.
FaceTime.
After we get out of the store.
This Android can grant you 3 wishes, even if one of those wishes is for an iPhone. I don't care. That's a funny video.
Last question of the night. It's from Jim Holmes. And he wants to know, failing cake or pie, Jim's the cake or pie guy. Do y'all think this downturn gives companies pause to rethink approaches to quality and craftsmanship? Anybody? Anybody want to jump in there? Or do I have to name names?
I think that the notion of a downturn is really dependent on your political views. If you don't like the current president that's in office, whether it's Bush or Obama or Clinton or Bush Sr., then you always think that they're doing a lousy job and the economy is in recession or depression or whatever. If you like the president, then the economy seems to be doing well. Is there an objective measure for how well the economy is doing? Because I've heard downturn
GDP.
And I've heard comeback. And I know I haven't seen too many places in Seattle personally doing layoffs, but maybe Seattle's different.
Yeah.
Well, there was Microsoft quite a few layoffs.
Yeah, but that was marketing sales.
You know, there's 10.1% unemployment, which is a real problem, and we're actually supposed to get new statistics tomorrow morning.
And the housing market is still doing very badly.
So that's bad. But when I look around the D.C. area, I mean, there's no problem, especially in the technology sector. I mean,
yeah, technology seems to be a lot of jobs.
Yeah, everybody's working.
Tons of jobs in Seattle. I don't know.
But what were you going to say, John, before we started talking about the economy?
Well, I was going to say that unfortunately, it would probably be the opposite, that if there is a downturn, if there are fewer people to do work, people actually don't think, okay, we've got fewer people, let's do this right. I think it's kind of more like, let's get this app done, let's get it out the door, I don't really care. You know, people don't want to think long-term and strategy, they want to get, you know, make do. So, I know in previous downturns I've been through that we went from, you know, big shop of people where one person could, you know, think big thoughts about our data access strategy down to one person maintaining an app that eight people used to, you know, corners get cut. So, depending again on your vantage point, if there is a downturn where you're at, I don't think that people take these opportunities to think, unless, you know, maybe it's, you know, shops where people continue to have their jobs but don't have a lot of work to do. But I haven't had that experience. I want an iPhone 4.
Yeah, I agree with John. I think it's kind of the other way around. That, you know, people get laid off, teams are smaller, they're under the gun more, more crunch. Generally doesn't lead to greater interest in software purity and craftsmanship, sadly. Even though if it did, you know, a lot of times better quality, better development practices speed things up rather than slow things down, but that's often a hard sell.
Hmm. Do you have any additional Scott? We have two Scotts, but did Scott
do we need more Scotts? That's plenty.
There's always room for one
all Scott
more.
Show. Any additional thoughts, Scott? Or did you just want to turn it into a political debate?
Well, it's kind of where the whole notion is that in order to take the context of the question into context, there has to be a downturn. And kind of depending on who you ask, you get different versions of whether or not there's a downturn. So it's hard to answer the question if you don't know if there's a downturn.
Jim's DE, right? Is he a DE? Developer evangelist?
No.
No. No, no, no. Sorry. Jim.
He's a free agent.
But he's in the Ohio area, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Organizer, which, one of, yeah.
I mean, Ohio, Michigan, I don't think it's very pretty there. But so
let's assume that let's just go ahead and assume that there is some sort of downturn. And would that affect craftsmanship? I think it's going to go by seniority, whoever's been there the longest, whoever has the most embedded knowledge. In terms of who they lay off, in terms of who they hire to replace, I think they're going to go with cheaper or possibly, it'll be networking. Who knows whose buddy can you hire? And so-and-so says they're good. They don't really take the whole craftsmanship part into it. So if craftsmanship exists at the shop already, then they're probably going to attract that more of that kind of developer. They're going to hire the same.
I think, maybe what Jim is doing is drawing a conclusion of, you know, there is a downturn and we're hearing people talk about software quality and craftsmanship are the two related. And I don't know, maybe some of it's just like our, you know, the people we know and hang out with are at that phase of, I don't know. Maybe I'll delete all this.
it's so hard to take, you know, your friend's thoughts seriously in terms of a larger scale. It's some kind of theory that when they talk about, you know, I can't believe that so-and-so won the election because nobody I know voted for them, you know, and you kind of take your close friends of five or six and extrapolate to 20 million. The numbers don't quite work out. It's kind of the same thing. Yeah. So I know five or six people talking about software craftsmanship. Therefore, if I extrapolate that out, you know, that's 80% of the people that I talk to on a regular basis, maybe. So 80% of all developers must be concerned about software craftsmanship, right? No. 80% of software developers haven't even heard of Fluent and Hibernate or, you know, the Craftsmanship Manifesto or, you know, Agile Open Conference 2010 or anything like that.
Yeah, I think business people, I think they would care about quality. But if you talk to them about craftsmanship, I think I don't think they'll appreciate that at all.
Well, they usually equate quality with bug-free.
Right. And you usually equate craftsmanship with, you know, the Stradivarius. I don't need a Stradivarius to chuck widgets through the factory every day and total up my orders. I just need something that works.
Exactly, because you know, Ed over here just finished up this other thing a lot quicker, and, you know, he's working on three apps right now, and he doesn't talk all day about, you know, craftsmanship, so...
He's got Lightwave.
There you go. It's like a commercial. We can make that commercial today.
I don't know. I think it's interesting, some of the craftsmanship stuff. I mean, I think it's great, and I enjoy the discussions about it, and I like to think of myself as someone that's continually trying to improve and craft stuff. But at the same time, I think sometimes, you know, I listen to some people talk about it, and they say, oh, I wish our profession was more like being a doctor, or being a lawyer, or being a scientist, and they have all these rules and codes of ethics and the way they do things. But, you know, we're still so young. And if you think about it, even like a chemist, it wasn't that long ago where, and I forget the name of the fellow who did this, but it was a German. It wasn't that long ago where someone was collecting urine in their basement and boiling it and trying to turn it into gold. You know, that was like the 1700s. And that was chemistry. No, it didn't work. No. But he did discover phosphorus, okay, which turns out to be important for people that want to, you know, light matches and shoot tracer rounds, I guess. But that whole alchemy thing was, you know, in the span of time was relatively recent. And I think, you know, I think software still hasn't even reached that alchemy phase yet. We're going to do some weird stuff and bad stuff, but we'll learn along the way.
Still not as weird as burning our urine, though. I hope.
Well, you know, urine's kind of yellowish and gold's kind of yellowish, and, you know.
It's an honest mistake.
World used to be flat. Earth used to be at the center of the universe. All these things seem plausible. You were going to make a PHP joke, Kevin.
I was going to say, well, PHP has inline script, and so WebMatrix should have inline script too.
That's right. Otherwise, the Catholic Church would have us thrown out. No, wait. I'm getting that backwards. Thank you for listening to this episode of Hurting Code. We hope you'll tune in again next week where we have less talk about urine.
90% less talk about urine.
But not 100% less.
No promises.